there's a God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who outdrew you.
Hello and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School podcast. My name is Jason Kirk.
And I'm Emily Kirk.
If this is your first time listening to this podcast, we are going through the entire Bible. That's the claim, at least. We've made it, as you can tell, incredibly far. Not really. We've really gotten bogged down in the book of Samuel. I say we as if you're the one responsible for the
bogging. I totally did it. It's my fault. I just needed more episodes.
if you're a newcomer, then you should know that we are not here to impose any particular religious tradition on you. Emily is a very chill believer, and I am. I have no investment whatsoever in what you believe, as long as you're nice. How about that?
We're not here to judge you.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, it's better if you're nice.
Yeah, we'll judge you if you're mean.
Yeah, but not on your religious standing.
So yeah, we are in the book of Samuel, which is the book that most people think of as like David and Goliath, and I don't know what else is going on. Well, we have discovered there is a lot going on. David is currently on the run from King Saul. Saul has been the king for the majority of the book of Samuel, and David is the guy who is appointed by God and the prophet Samuel to take Saul's place. David has killed Goliath. David has found a boyfriend who happens to be the son of the king. Romantic intrigue there.
Mm-hmm.
Is not officially boyfriend. You can listen to our last episode. It doesn't say the word boyfriend, but...
It doesn't not say it either.
It does not say the word boyfriend. You can check it in the Hebrew. Real quick before we get going on this one, first of all, a content warning. We're talking about the story of David and Bathsheba, and there are many interpretations of that story, and... one of the most prominent ones is that David raped Bathsheba. So, heads up, that is a thing that we will be discussing. The other thing, as far as the business of this podcast goes, let's get some podcast reviews out there. Let's get some new reviews. Let's freshen our reviews page a little bit.
I'll go review right now.
You haven't?
Oh.
I don't know if I have.
No.
It feels deeply unethical.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. That's weird.
Hi, I think I did a great job.
Our dogs will do it for us.
They sure appear often enough that it's a conflict of interest for them as well. But yeah, the reviews page currently, there's one on there. Someone accused me of stealing a Lord of the Rings joke from them, and so they went and left an angry review.
Wait,
on
what?
The podcast. Yeah, I'm like, bro, the last thing in the world I need help with is a Lord of the Rings meme. It was that Elvis movie. There was a meme of Tom Hanks looking really excited saying, "He's white." So I made a joke about Gandalf coming back, Gandalf the White, and someone appeared to say, how dare you steal my joke? And it's like, man, this is, no.
I'm sure, like...
Anyway.
Okay.
We need to get that review wiped away with some reviews of actual listeners. If that person is listening, I forgive you. I forgive you for what you've accused me of.
What a weird thing to go write a review about.
It's like a thing I would have completely forgotten about, but every time I look at our podcast page, I see it there, and I just want rid of it.
Wow. Good to know.
Yeah. Otherwise, we have a Patreon page where I always forget to do the business at the beginning of the episode. I do it at the very end, but this time around,
look at us go.
We're going to see what happens if we do it this time. We have a Patreon page where we're doing monthly-ish episodes, monthly at this point. Let's call it monthly.
Okay.
On not Bible stuff, religion stuff. Usually Christian stuff, often modern stuff, sometimes a little bit historical, but usually quite modern, sometimes stuff
not
in
usually
the news.
Anything good.
Well, I said religious stuff, so yeah.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be nice if there was like a religious episode that we did that it was like, look at the wonderful things that these people did.
Yeah, I mean, we could do that. We could find some like Christian anarchists who are stealing
something unique. It's not like we donated to the missions fund,
stealing toys for the children or whatever.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. I mean, we do fun ones on usually on Christian music.
Yeah.
And also, we are on various social networks. Instagram, I always forget to update. Twitter, will that exist by the time you listen to this? I don't know. We're on Blue Sky, though. I think Blue Sky will probably exist for a while.
You're on Blue Sky.
You're as noted on our Blue Sky page. You are not online enough to care about being on Blue Sky.
It's true.
So let us get right to the story. To this point in the book of Samuel, we have established a pattern where the person who prepares the notes gets very bogged down in one chapter, and we end up making about only a chapter's worth of progress.
Oh, way to go.
I don't know who that could be.
Me either. Couldn't have been you.
I don't know whose fault that is. But this time around, the person who prepares the notes has set it up so we're going to attempt to sprint through like 20 chapters before we get to our topic, all right?
What?
So David is on the run from King Saul, his technically father-in-law. David also married Princess Michal, Saul's daughter. And Saul is trying to eliminate his threat to the throne. So let's begin. David and his little gang of fellow breakaway soldiers, they're on the run. David shows up to a priest and asks for bread. The priest says, well, I have holy bread for priests, but I tell you what, your men who've avoided sex with women can eat it. Yes, he specifies, with women, and fortunately, David's only been sneaking off in the woods with Jonathan. The main thing is this is foreshadowing. This shows David is very aware that Israel's soldiers avoid sex during war. Huge foreshadowing. There's a thing where David asks the priest, he's lying to the priest, King Saul sent me on a secret mission and I need a weapon. Do you happen to have one? And the priest is like, well, here's the sword you killed Goliath with.
Wow.
This is where it ended up.
Why doesn't he still have that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's on the one hand, this feels like a video game thing where you have unlocked the sword of bigness. And the other one is like, okay, this is just how religious people act. Like, think of how many, you know, Catholic and Orthodox churches are like, here's the relic of that time Paul clipped his toenails. Here's the one and only Goliath sword.
Like, if Goliath was that big of a deal, then why wouldn't the guy who killed him have that as like a token of memorabilia?
Yeah. According to the story, he ran off with Goliath's head.
So he wanted that instead.
He must have just dropped the sword and ran off with the thing that'll decompose.
If he used Goliath's sword, wasn't his sword very large?
Yeah. Yeah. So this priest yeah. pulls out a sword the size of a priest and says, wouldn't you know it, kid? How convenient is that? Note the important thing here is David has gone from mocking Goliath's reliance on a heathen sword instead of trusting in God to wielding it, to needing it. And in my opinion, here's the thing that I will check in on as often as I can as I sprint through these notes. Here is a really big clue in this part of the story that this book's authors are warning us about David. Like, to this point, David's been the perfect special boy, and parts of the Bible will consider him that going forward. But I think the book of Samuel does some sneaky things here, including one that's not so sneaky, which is like, hey, this guy's literally running around with, like, the most dangerous sword that ever belonged to any of our enemies. It feels like a heads up. Saul orders not just this priest who is nice to David killed, but 85 priests and all the women and children in their town. Saul, who was God's first Messiah and the guy who used to get in trouble for not killing innocent people, is not only killing his own innocent people. It seems bad to be a Bible character who's declared war on priests.
Yeah.
It's not one of the 10 rules, but it feels like it's sort of so obvious.
I mean, it kind of is.
Well, I mean, technically murder.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But to this point, you know, we've seen a lot of that, I guess. Yeah. At this point, lots of scholars compare King Saul to Macbeth, another king who descends into a violent downfall while paranoid about a rival. People have pointed out Shakespeare wrote Macbeth for King James, a noted Bible guy.
Mm. King James. Never heard of him.
King James and King David. Gay Bible kings. David obtains a fortune-telling device, blah, blah, blah. David roams the wilderness, always ahead of Saul. Jonathan finds him out there and makes his biggest proclamation yet. David, you will be king instead of my dad, and I'll be your number two. Let's seal another pact alone together in nature. This is the prince declaring himself an outright enemy of his father, which I find very romantic. Then there's this famous sequence where David has a chance to kill Saul while Saul's peeing from a cave over the Dead Sea, but David is too innocent to do it. David just cuts off part of Saul's garment so he can say, look, I could have killed you, but I'm too innocent. And Saul can say, my boy, you're so innocent, I won't try to kill you anymore. So there's something that happens over and over and over from this point on. The authors go so very far out of their way to present violence as never David's fault. And in fact, all the way back to the beginning, Goliath started it. Saul kept starting it. And we'll see that continue to such a degree that it starts to feel sarcastic. Most scholars argue that the Bible's authors are propagandists trying to present everything in favorable to David. But my stupid opinion, just based on, I don't know, the vibe I get from it, is the authors of this book, the Book of Samuel, are more sophisticated than that. Considering everything they show David doing, how complex their characterizations are, and how over the top the David is doing nothing wrong stuff is, I feel like David constantly being presented as cartoonishly upstanding, despite gaining from everyone around him killing each other, reads as mockery of David propaganda. Here's an example.
Okay.
David is trying to get some food from a rich asshole who just so happens to have a hot wife. That's a paraphrase of how he's introduced. The asshole's like, "No, I will be inhospitable to you." And David tells his band of travelers, "Everybody grab your swords." Where'd that come from?
He loves them. Loves the swords.
Yeah, this is a big swords guy all of a sudden. Like the boy who started as, "All I need is my staff and my little handful of pebbles and my God." Mm-hmm. Now he's waving swords at this guy. So like with Bible logic, sure, being inhospitable is bad. So like, okay, David's fine to get angry at this guy. But come on, David started this. I think the authors are aware of the irony of presenting a guy as blameless and then immediately having him invade someone's territory and start a fight. Either way, something happened within the last couple chapters that made David think he has the right to anything he wants. Was it the priest giving him bread that he was technically unworthy for? Was it David accepting Goliath's sword and trusting only in masculine power? Did David hear about Saul's massacre and decide to become just as ruthless? Was David humiliated by being separated from both of his lovers, Prince Jonathan and Princess Michal, and decide to take it out on somebody else? And if he gets what he wants here, will David become addicted to this kind of power? So the shepherd's hot wife, Abigail, goes to beautiful fugitive David and throws herself on the ground. "I'm so sorry for my asshole husband. You'll be a great king since you haven't killed anyone. Because you are so innocent, according to the authors of this story, who we were supposed to take at total face value. And I bet my husband won't live very long. And once he's dead, please remember how hot I am." It's basically your speech. And people have taken this speech a lot of ways. The Israeli novelist Mir Shalev argued Abigail was, wink, wink, promising to kill her husband, hoping David would then marry her into royalty. David says some insane stuff. "Abigail, if you hadn't said such nice stuff to me just now, I would have killed you and every man in this place."
Just killing women now.
So Abigail goes home and finds her asshole husband drunk. She waits until he's sober to tell him everything she just told David. The husband dies of heartbreak or something. And as soon as David finds out hot Abigail is single, he says, "Blessed be the Lord!"
Heartbreak poison.
Hey, that's it.
They didn't test for it back then.
So that's a good one. Mm-hmm. The guy likes drinking stuff. We know that about him.
Maybe she got all that arsenic out of them apple seeds.
Okay, that's good. I love it. It's a good theory. Whatever seeds they had in the area that were the equivalent. Yeah. So for thousands of years, fanfic guys have loved Abigail. I think they imagine themselves walking into a fight and being so cool that the pretty lady leaves with them. One ancient rabbi decided Abigail was flashing her thighs at David while telling him not to lust at her, like the "we're just friends" scenes in Walk Hard. I've heard this story described by Christian men as sanctified romance, a woman leaving a drunkard for a man of God. But remember, David admitted he thought about killing Abigail, who was cautious around her drunk hothead husband anyway. Wilda Gaffney describes Abigail as good at surviving violent men by stroking their egos. She writes, "This union is no more romantic than those of battered women who do and say anything to calm their abusers." Just in case there's any doubt about whether David is has given Abigail his heart to start an American Christian nuclear family, he adds another wife while traveling to the honeymoon.
Wow.
Biblical marriage.
And he was already married before this.
So right. But King Saul steps in to give David's previous wife, Princess Michal, to another man, which isn't legal.
Only men can marry multiples.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, it's like the sliding some one spouse to another.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
Saul's just making stuff up there. Michal loved David at one point. The Bible said so. And now she's a pawn in a feud between two men. All of this, the entire Abigail Michal sequence here, is loaded with foreshadowing. There's a repeat story where Saul tries to kill David again, and David has another chance to kill Saul, but doesn't. Some scholars think it's an accidentally placed and out of order or whatever, but I think it works because it, you know, shows Saul breaking a promise, and it makes the David didn't do violence thing even harder to believe. So I think it works the way it is. Let's leave the Bible as it is. David becomes a Philistine to escape Saul.
What?
Sure. It's the last place they'll look. It's the people they've been at war with for this entire book. Yep. And the last one as well. David, as a Philistine, leads a murderous bandit gang, which is fine because he doesn't kill Israelites. So he's gone from not killing anyone to he kills people, sure, but... And there's this dramatic tension about this upcoming Philistine-Israelite battle. Will David fight with his new friends against his enemy King Saul, or will he switch sides again and fight within Israel against its arch enemy? Right before this battle, Saul is sick and tired of having no way to tell the future. In previous episodes, he kept going catatonic at the sight of a big army, never knowing whether to attack or not. So, especially now that David has found a fortune-telling device with that bread priest, Saul disguises himself and asks a necromancer to consult a spirit for him. And she's like, King Saul kicked out all the witches and wizards. We're in the Bible. You know that, right? Are you trying to get me killed by King Saul? And I love this because we know King Saul is the tallest man in Israel. So, like, what kind of disguise is he going to put on that she doesn't recognize him, right? Like, she knows she's talking to the king. And again, Saul sounds very like Macbeth here. Saul, who should he call forth but his former prophet Samuel, a guy who hated him. Samuel's irate about being woken from his dead guy slumber or whatever. And Samuel says, tomorrow, Saul, your whole family is coming to Dead World. And Saul is again so catatonic that the necromancer has to convince him to eat some food she's cooked. Important side note here, this is the first time in the entire Bible there's been any indication of any afterlife at all. And Samuel doesn't say, I was having a good time in paradise, or a bad time in Hades, or a whatever time in purgatory. Based on the theology revealed to this point, Samuel had been sleeping in the underworld, which is what dead bodies do. If the book of Samuel is trying to tell us that there's some sort of an animated afterlife, then that makes this yet another Samuel episode where things sound pretty Greek. Chapter 29, it's now tomorrow, the day King Saul is going to die. The Philistines, they don't trust David for, I don't know why. I don't know why they...
Who knows?
What's their problem with David? So they kick him out and he goes far away. And the story, like, the authors bend over backward to tell us how far away he goes on some whole side quest. Because they're like, look, see, when Saul dies, David wasn't anywhere near. It wasn't David's fault. It's just so sarcastic. It's so over the top how hard they go. Chapter 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled, and many fell. The Philistines killed Jonathan and the other two sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard on Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by them. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, so that these uncircumcised may not make sport of me." But his armor bearer was unwilling, for he was terrified. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. The Philistines cut off Saul's head, stripped off his armor, and strung his body on a wall. Saul's body is beheaded, just like David beheaded Goliath. Revenge.
Poor Jonathan.
Jonathan's the one guy we're sad about losing here. We enter in your Christian Bibles, we enter a portion called 2 Samuel. If you're reading in your Hebrew Bible, you are just stay put. You're already in the right place. It's split because in the oldest Greek translations, Samuel had to split in order to fit on scrolls. And also at the time, it was often paired with a two-part Book of Kings. So the things we think of as 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings were known a couple thousand years ago as the Book of Kingdoms. The story picks up with a young man running up to David and saying he killed Saul out of mercy. The story just told us Saul killed himself. The main thing is this kid tells David that Jonathan's dead. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord. David said to the young man who had reported to him, "Were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David had the kid killed. When I say kid, it's a soldier. I don't mean it's like a five-year-old.
Thank you.
Robert Alter notes, it's very convenient. David gets to profit from Saul's death while also publicly punishing somebody for it. David will spend the next several chapters doing that over and over. David then wrote a song, the rare example so far of someone besides a woman doing this, mourning Saul and Jonathan. It lies about what a good guy Saul was, lies about Saul and Jonathan still being on good terms, and coins the phrase, "How the mighty have fallen." That's where that comes from. During this poem, David calls Jonathan brother. Does that debunk what we said in our previous episode about how their love did not seem brotherly? Well, this poem was a public proclamation, but we saw how they felt about each other. Deep, soul-binding physical affection in private moments. And even in this public poem, David says he loved Jonathan more than he loved women.
Wow.
I mean,
pretty bold.
I guess it could be clearer, but David mourning Saul might seem strange. Saul tried to kill David 100 times, but scholars note that by loudly mourning Saul's death, David's less likely to be blamed for it. And I think it's clear whose death David is genuinely mourning. Mm-hmm. So David's the king now. The next 3 chapters are about him consolidating power and wiping out Saul's loyalists, all without taking the blame for any of the constant violence that benefits him. The Bible shows him performing remorse as assassins keep killing his enemies. And like, I can't believe the theory that these authors who didn't trust Eli or Samuel or Saul are sincerely trying to present David as just lucking into greater power all the time. James Kugel describes David's ascent to the throne as a military coup dressed up by religious ceremonies. Robert Alter says, the author continually exercises an unblinking vision of David and the institution of the monarchy that exposes the terrible flaws even while accepting their divinely authorized legitimacy. So all the guys jockeying for power are fighting over things, including Saul's former concubines, because this whole story is about men claiming power via the bodies of women. David says something that I read as, you guys took a concubine who should have belonged to me, so you owe me back my ex-wife, Princess Michal. David's soldiers take Michal from a heartbroken husband by threatening to kill him. Commentators note this reconquest of Michal is not about love, but about a claim to her dead father's kingdom. Biblical marriage! The moment we're approaching was not the first or even second time David decided he should take a woman in order to spite a man. The Bible's authors show Abigail and Michal weren't just part of a pattern, but an escalation. He's gone from conniving with a woman against her bad husband to kidnapping a woman from her loving husband, and he's far from done. It's a crazy thing to remember here. At this point in the story, conservative Christian men still read David as the most virtuous guy in the world. Like, they think his only big sin hasn't happened yet.
Right.
Even though he's killed people, he's essentially kidnapped this woman. Like,
and he's gay.
And there's that. The only cool thing about him...
They don't believe that part.
Chapter 6, David's conquered Jerusalem. Oh, hey, there's the important city is here now. The Ark of the Lord entered the city of David. And it's this huge moment, and it feels like, wow, this could be like the end of the story, right? Like the most important object is now in the most important city. Like, are we done here, you know? So what happens during this moment of glorious triumph when David has basically accomplished everything the nation set out to do? Princess Michal looked out the window and saw her husband dancing before the Lord, and she despised him.
Good for her.
Finally, someone with some sense. Not only is the king frolicking, he's wearing a priest's apron-like garment, meaning he's probably flapping his nude ball sack against special clothing in church.
This happens.
Does it?
I mean, in the Bible, it seems to.
Oh. Yeah. Lots of weird male genitalia going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She marches up to him and says, "How the king of Israel honors himself, uncovering himself before the eyes of the servant girls like any vulgar fellow." Finally, someone speaking up to David. This is his first wife, who risked her life for him when Saul was trying to kill him. He's reclaimed her from a loving husband for reasons having nothing to do with her personality. And she's now seeing him thrust his balls at the Ark of the Covenant. So on the one hand, this can be read as her being a Baptist and judging him for dancing, or her being a Republican and judging him for associating with poor people, or her being a princess who's jealous her husband is the monarch instead of her. And I doubt this was a thing that you heard much about in church, but we were always taught that Michal was being like a grumpy churchgoer who didn't like it when other people worshiped the Lord with all their hearts.
Huh. Maybe she's just tired of him.
Right, I think that's it. Like,
everything he does is going to annoy her at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. Like, this is a warlord flaunting himself at subordinate women.
Mm-hmm.
A warlord who's already twice demonstrated he's willing to claim vulnerable women. So, like, considering where this story is going, I think Michal sees right through him, and I think she's the voice of God here. Like, she knows him better than any of these subordinates do anyway. David says... He's such a bitch here. "It was before the Lord who chose me in place of your father and all his household that I have danced."
He's just taunting her.
Yeah, his household, including you.
Yeah.
Brutal. Never mind that it was her who chose him to not be killed by her father. David says, basically, and speaking of honor, I think I'll honor myself with the slave girls, if you know what I mean. The Bible notes, Michal and David never had any children. And I was taught this was because God had cursed her with barrenness for not letting David worship. I think it's right.
Up to this point.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. She looks around, looks over at David's dozen wives and just thinks, he's your problem now, ladies. Like, I'm just going to go sit in the window.
He's so cool. I'd really want to make babies with him, too.
Right. Sign me up for that. Chapter 7, the ark sitting in a tent in Jerusalem, maybe the tabernacle from Exodus, and God tells the prophet Nathan to tell David, one of David's successors will build a temple for the ark, and that the house of David will rule forever.
Oh, boy.
Forever will be like 400 years, losing half its territory along the way. That's evidence this was written not long after the potentially real King David, but also evidence that the Bible is sometimes wrong when it comes to things like numbers. Also, the Book of Numbers is, I think it's just generally wrong. David swears loyalty to God with a long speech that calls to mind Moses' Deuteronomy speeches about doing a very specific kind of monotheism. We've seen Joshua and Saul also do this. Chapter 8, David's armies kill and enslave a bunch of people. It's established that David knows this guy named Joab is horrible and untrustworthy. Joab, who's this one of his generals, basically. There's this hilarious pair of sentences in chapter 8. It was David's practice to mete out true justice to all his people, and Joab was in charge of the army. Those two sentences, one after the other, one of them is not true. Whoever wrote this knows that. This is not propaganda. This is like sneak disses all the way through. And, you know, most scholars would disagree with me, and they're smarter than I am, but I trust my feelings here.
Good job.
Chapter 9, David does something that seems cool. He basically adopts his departed boyfriend Jonathan's son, which sounds nice at first. The Bible emphasizes this kid has severely handicapped feet, and scholars note this means David can demonstrate he's not stealing the throne from Jonathan's son because a king had to physically lead troops into battle. So he can say, like, well, you know, this kid couldn't be king, right? He couldn't lead the army. I guess I'll be the king. I'll lead the army, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing here is this means the last members of Saul's family are Jonathan's son and Michal, and both of them are stuck with David.
Woo.
Chapter 10, David conquers some people, blah, blah, blah. Scholars note, at this point in the story, David doesn't go out to war anymore, even though the previous chapter was about how kings must personally lead battles. This is very important. David just sends the scoundrel General Joab to do all the war for him. Okay, chapter 11.
I read this one.
Yes, we have now gotten to the point where Emily has read.
I'm caught up.
I said she only needed to read these two chapters. Chapter 11, the Bible says, at the time of the year when kings go forth into battle, David remained in Jerusalem. Are you trying to tell me the Book of Samuel is pro-David propaganda? Listen to that again. When kings go to battle, David remained in Jerusalem. How much clearer could they make it without, you know, getting in trouble?
And he's so big and tough, so why couldn't he have gone into battle? And I don't get it.
Yeah, like, I mean, he's just lazy at this point. He likes power. He likes all this stuff. He just sits around and tells other people to kill each other. So, it happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch. Lazy. Like, what is this, like 3 p.m.? He's finally rolling off the couch. The guy who's in charge during war.
Yeah, he's having a great time.
David was walking about on the roof of his house, and he saw from the roof a beautiful woman bathing.
Just happened to see from the roof of his house.
Yeah, when he's stumbling around in a stupor at 4:30 in the afternoon. I think right here there's this meme of Demi Lovato a long time ago. She posted these words. I don't know what she meant by them, but I find them apt here. Get a job. Stay away from her. Lazy king. Leave this woman alone. So this is Bathsheba. Note, the Bible does not say a word about her trying to make sure David saw her bathing, even though that's what you'll hear in church and pop culture. There's a notion that she was bathing on her roof. The Bible doesn't say that, but like, what, she would have to like lug buckets of water upstairs. There's not internal plumbing here.
I mean, and right, there's no internal plumbing, but there's probably a place where they tend to bathe anyhow.
Right. So if she did bathe on her roof, he probably knew that.
Right.
And he thought, this is when I wake up at at 5:15 in the afternoon, there's usually a woman bathing. I will go happen to stare at her. So yeah, I mean, or he could have just been spying through a window, you know, for all we know. Like, yeah, like the idea that she was displaying herself for him is probably a lot of dudes reading that into the story. Also, a lot of people assume she was naked because painters like to paint her. But the Bible only describes her cleaning herself after her period, essentially, meaning she could be mostly clothed. Scholar Lee Powers writes, she was conducting a ritual of purification. This strengthens the conclusion that Bathsheba was not trying to entice David.
Yeah, I'm not trying to entice anyone at that point in my life.
In a moment such
yeah.
as that.
Yeah. Like, yeah, leave me alone, especially if I'm at the point where I'm needing to clean up.
Right, yeah. And it's like, all these, you know, romantic paintings of David, like fawning for her. Like, if you depicted the actual thing, he would look like the world's biggest pervert, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is accurate. That's, I mean, it says it's, you know, it says it's a cleansing ritual. That's not supposed to entice anyone.
And this doesn't mean that he couldn't have also liked Jonathan.
Well, right. David was bi.
Right.
David was either bi or he viewed women as simply objects for power.
Right.
So David's lazy ass sends someone to her, and they find out Bathsheba's married to a Hittite named Uriah, who's out in the battlefield, the place David's lazy ass is supposed to be. Some scholars believe she was also the daughter and granddaughter of two of David's top guys. So when David looks at her, he doesn't just want to conquer her. David perceives women as the way to dominate men. He looks at her and he thinks, I can get one over on this soldier and two other guys at the same time.
So he would have had to have known who she was and who she was married to.
Yeah, it's gathering a lot of information. The Bible surely knows at this point. So.
Right.
So David, a guy with at least seven wives plus concubines, has someone bring Bathsheba in. And you noted the verbs throughout this part are... not exactly romantic.
Yeah, I read the NIV version, which basically said he slept with her. It does not say they slept together, that she slept with him. It says he slept with her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Scholar Anthony Campbell points out the verb says David took her. David has his way with her and sends her back home. The text doesn't confirm whether she wanted any of this.
Right. It doesn't say that she fell in love with him. It doesn't say all the things that you would typically find.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing we saw with Michal.
Yeah.
It said Michal loved David.
Right.
It said Jonathan loved David.
Right.
It tells us when people love David, right?
Yeah. Doesn't sound like she does.
There's no indication. The Bible says she then found a way to inform David he'd impregnated her. Wilda Gaffney points out how humiliating this must have been. Did Bathsheba have to tell a guard at the gate and ask him to tell someone who could tell David? Did she worry the whole nation would whisper about what she did with the Messiah? Doesn't this sound like what people have to worry about to this day after being used by priests and pastors? Once David finds out she's pregnant, he brings her husband Uriah back from the war. He urges him to sleep with his wife, trying to avoid Bathsheba's pregnancy becoming evidence against the king. Uriah instead slept outside David's house and said, how can I go party with my wife when my fellow soldiers are out in the field? Uriah is a Hittite, a foreigner, who's observing Israelite customs better than the king is. And remember how this episode opened with David very clearly knowing soldiers are celibate during war. That's how far removed from reality he is in just these few chapters. The life of a devout soldier is now forgotten, even as he's ordering those men to fight and die for him. David gets Uriah drunk and again tries to send him home. Uriah doesn't do it. He does his job. Frustrated, David sends Uriah to the noted scumbag, General Joab. Uriah is supposed to fight on the front lines, and then Joab should pull away from him, abandoning him to die. Which is an impossible order because it'd require Joab to involve, like, the whole army in a conspiracy against one guy. But David, a lazy-ass king, no longer thinks about battle tactics. Uriah does die, but General Joab along the way accidentally gets a bunch of other guys killed too. So Joab bullshits David about it. We had to get real close, too close to danger in order to get Uriah killed. It's just a bunch of people like trying to profit from this guy's death. And it sort of when Joab talks to David, it sort of sounds like Joab knows about Bathsheba because he makes a reference to a story from the book of Judges about a man dying because he got too close to a woman. So maybe Joab, the guy whose dirty work keeps benefiting the squeaky clean king, is saying, let's both forget some things we know. Once David hears Uriah's dead, he just sends Joab a little pep talk. David hastily forgiving Joab is super noteworthy. Joab has borderline betrayed David before and will do so in our next episode, but David's overlooking it all just to avoid responsibility for impregnating Bathsheba.
He's a good guy. One of the best.
To this point, the lots and lots of Christian men would say, he has done one thing wrong. One, maybe two. Bathsheba mourns her husband, and David sent and brought her to his house. No matter how she feels about her husband's killer, she has to become the killer's eighth or so wife. And I wonder if David then presents himself as a hero for taking care of his soldier's pregnant widow.
Probably.
And now, making a very rare appearance in the book of Samuel, somebody we haven't heard from in a long time. Here comes God.
Welcome back.
God tells the prophet Nathan to confront David. Imagine God's heartbreak here. David is the man after God's own heart, the one God counted on to make up for Saul being a failed Messiah. And after all that violence David connived his way out of, now the king's hands are blood red. Confronting David is still going to take enormous courage. Remember, David's predecessor killed 85 priests, and Nathan knows that David might just think Nathan's trying to manipulate him the same way Samuel manipulated Saul. So, like, being a prophet who God is told to confront a king, it's even harder than it sounds, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it could just kill you. But Nathan challenges David in a creative way. Probably knowing David grew up as a poor shepherd, he says, pretend there's a rich man who has a lot of sheep, and there's a poor man who has only one lamb, and he cuddles her to sleep every night. Now say, the rich man butchered the poor man's beloved lamb. What should happen? So David, who's very established as a guy who loves exclaiming things that sound righteous, exclaims, that rich man deserves to die. Nathan says, that rich man is you. You killed the poor man Uriah so you could claim his wife. You've embarrassed God. You're going to be punished. Horrible things are going to happen to your kingdom and your family. Innocent people will suffer. More women will end up abused because of you. Nathan's words get through. David is broken and ashamed, never the same after this moment. It was one of the very rare times that a man stood up to David. Mahal did it first.
Yeah.
So, there is a debate that's burned for a long time. It flares up on Christian internet several times a year, and we'll talk about that with a guest in just a few. It revolves around this question, did David rape Bathsheba? There are lots of interpretations. The one argument you can't make is that he definitely didn't. Legal definitions have changed over time. We don't know whether Bathsheba loudly resisted David, as ancient laws might have required of her at the time, but defying a violent warlord would have risked her life. Rabbi David Zucker writes, the power differential between David and Bathsheba is momentous. This is a sordid tale of rape and murder. And besides, like, it drives me crazy when people do, like, you have to judge the Bible character who we're saying is perfect by the standards of the time. And it's like, are you saying God's standards change? Like, if this guy is a holy hero to this day, shouldn't he have been at the time? There's more evidence David victimized Bathsheba than there is evidence Bathsheba did anything wrong at all. Scholar Rachel Adelman writes, the narrative seems to exonerate Bathsheba of any guilt and is exclusively concerned with the king's degeneracy. The prophet Nathan depicted Bathsheba not as someone who sought out consensual sin with David, but as an innocent life slaughtered by David. If a sexual sin happened, but only one person was to blame for it, there's a word for that. God's prophet said David abducted and butchered a creature that represents Bathsheba. Nathan chose the sheep metaphor not because he thinks Bathsheba is a farm animal, but to present Bathsheba as a helpless victim. According to Nathan, David ended two innocent lives, Uriah's, plus the life Bathsheba knew, a life of not being controlled by a colonizing tyrant. Or you can flip it around. You can say, what if the rich man is David, the poor person was Bathsheba, and the lamb who was slaughtered is Uriah, because Uriah is the one who got killed. If you flip it around, then he's still saying, you killed an innocent person, and you have wronged another person. There's two ways of reading it. It's usually translated as Bathsheba is the lamb, but you could read it the other way as well. If David's sin wasn't rape, then why does Nathan specifically predict the consequences of David's actions will include other women being taken advantage of? And why does the next part of the story very clearly depict a man influenced by David committing an even more explicit sex crime? These outcomes are the result of the culture the king established. When we tell our sons to look up to abusive men, how will they treat our daughters? So obviously, lots of women view this story as about a privileged male using power to control a woman instead of a story about consensual adultery. But powerful Christian men have argued David's sins against Uriah and Bathsheba were just coveting and adultery and a little secondhand murder. Some of those arguments are in good faith. It's possible to believe Bathsheba might have consented. but some of those men are predisposed to exonerate David. I know this because those men argue women's clothing is to blame for sexual assault. Priests should get shuffled around to new jobs despite touching children. Wives aren't allowed to turn down husbands. Women are lying about being fondled by denomination presidents. And only men are worthy of being pastors and popes. Why do those guys love David so much? They tell each other the story of David is about male leaders being restored to leadership after a mistake. Those guys love to point out how sorry David was. They like to cite Psalm 51. The author of Psalm 51 had David say this, "Against you and you only, God, have I sinned." That's their role model. It seems insane to invest personal emotion in arguing a random hillbilly gangster named David was a gentleman when he cheated on his dozen wives 3,000 years ago. But that's how invested certain men are in David being their path to not getting fired. The things we know about Bathsheba after this story. One of her sons is named after Nathan, and Nathan and Bathsheba worked together against David to push one of her sons onto the throne. I believe the day Nathan gained Bathsheba's trust was the day he held a man of God accountable.
Probably.
So yeah. Those are the facts of the matter. Let us break from heavy things to discuss some fun things, but also some different kinds of heavy things.
Yeah.
We're going to talk to a guest.
Heavy things in a fun way.
A more fun way than this, yes.
Yeah.
And we'll be back to wrap up the bulk of the Book of Samuel. There's still a bit left over after this episode, but our next episode we will be into the Book of Kings.
Look at that.
Folks, we are delighted to be joined by April Ajoy, a famous person on Christian internet, I would say. And for this episode, as you know, as the subject matter veers into Christian internet, we thought it'd be appropriate to bring on a veteran who's seen some things in those trenches. April, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm pretty good. We're recording this in the near the middle of summer, so we're all just surviving. But Emily just got back from the aquarium and
I have salty dolphin water here.
It's feeling very humid.
Nice.
So April, one of the first things we do whenever we bring someone on is we talk a little bit about religious background. From my part of the world I come from, this would be referred to as, you know, giving our testimony. I believe this is a term that's familiar for you.
Yes.
Because it's really rare that I talk to someone who had a background that I would describe as arguably more evangelical than mine. and you might have that. So.
Wow.
Could you feel,
what?
Could you,
I need a trophy.
Sad trophy, but so could you catch us up on where you've been and how you and where you are now, I guess.
Wow, that's a very loaded question. But yeah, the gist, I guess, is I was a PK, so I was a preacher's kid. My dad was a Pentecostal evangelist. And then my grandfather pastored a really large church in the Dallas, Texas area when I was growing up. So I had like multiple generations of pastors above me. So we're non-denominational, but kind of like Assemblies of God was how my grandfather was ordained. So we were basically Assemblies of God, but without the like higher up, I don't know, hierarchy of boards and trustees and all that stuff. So I sang. I was a singer growing up and would sing before my dad would preach and like different, we called them crusades, which in hindsight,
yeah,
feels weird.
kind of a heads up there.
Yeah. But basically what that meant is, you know, the local churches would like rent out stadiums or convention centers or just large fields. And then, you know, they'd have worship. And then me or my mom or my brothers, I had two brothers, would sing. And then my dad would preach. And so sometimes that we were on like Christian TV. So like my dad did a lot of Christian radio and Christian TV. And so occasionally I would sing like before he would be interviewed, I guess. And I guess the most evangelical like highlight reel I could give is that when I was 18, my dad my whole family actually went on the Jim Baker show because they were interviewing my dad for a book he wrote called America Say Jesus. And then I wrote a song also called America Say Jesus that was supposed to like go along with the book. And so I sang it. I performed it on the Jim Baker show. And it's like so Christian nationalist. timeless. The lyrics are terrible looking back on it. And it's like the Jim Beggar Show is filmed in Branson, Missouri. So it's like all these, it's like a bunch of white senior citizens, like totally everyone's clapping on a different beat. But I've, you know, I was on TV, so it's like, oh, this is kind of cool, like, I guess. I don't know. And then later, as an adult, I worked for CBN, like the 700 Club, went to Pat Robertson's university. Wow. Yeah. So that's not everything, but that's a good summary. Yeah. Oh, and then where I am now, or what I do now, is that, yeah, was that part of it? Well,
give us the big contrast.
Yeah. The big contrast. I would call myself an ex-evangelical. I'm still a Christian, but I'm progressive, very like LGBTQ affirming. I don't know. Sounds all like- the Yeah. So I guess what sets me apart, because there's obviously a lot of like deconstructed people out there and like ex-evangelicals on Twitter and stuff. And so I guess what makes me, I don't know if it makes me different, it sounds weird, but I try to like call out the harmful parts of evangelicalism, but I use humor to do it. So I'll wear like wigs and I'll dress in drag to be like a male pastor and just mimic. Honestly, a lot of them are almost like verbatim actual experiences of my life.
Not to say that you don't have a talent, but you don't have to try that hard in some circumstances to come up with some lines, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. No, it's like just full on experience. It's so funny, too. Like the people that didn't grow up religious that see it, they're like, oh, my gosh, there's no way. This is so exaggerated. I'm like, it's actually not.
Yes. It's impossible to parody. No, I'm just remembering. Yeah. So a lot of your videos, your work goes on TikTok, where I have so very little experience in TikTok. It's nothing against it at all. It's just not like how my personal brain works. So like when you, and like the stuff you do there is very funny. Like I see the ones you post to Twitter where it's like there's a lot where it's literally like how the women's Christian conference goes, where it's basically like telling all the women to find a good man and get married and all that. Or it's like, you know, pretending to be a church man and saying completely ridiculous things. And like the joke of it is, listen to how funny it sounds when you put it in a very slightly different context. Or the one when there's this pastor, Matt Chandler, a couple of years ago, who said people only deconstruct their religion because it's sexy. So April's doing like religious trauma. See how sexy that is.
Existential crisis. It's like a 1-900 number, like those late night commercials that came on back in the 90s. You watched, stayed up too late as a kid.
After you watched Jim Baker, yeah. Would you?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm curious, being an ex-evangelical creator on TikTok, what is like the vibe over there? Like, do people, are there Theo bros on TikTok? Is it as combative as other parts of the internet? I'm just curious, I guess.
Yes, it is. It was more combative early on. I will say TikTok does a better job of kind of showing your content to people that want to see it. Like the algorithm is much more niche especially once you've been on for a while. So I've been on for, I don't know, I guess three years now. So it mostly shows my stuff to people that are like-minded. I mean, obviously I get hate comments a lot. But it's narrowed it down, I guess, a lot more. But early on, especially, there'd be like Theo bros, like on Twitter, you know, you get quote tweeted by Theo bros, and then on TikTok, you get stitched, and they'll like stitch your video and they're like, well, actually, and then go into their whole thing. So it's kind of funny, but yes, there's definitely a lot of hate there. I would say I actually get the most hate right now on Instagram, which is weird. Yeah. Aww. But it just, it ebbs and flows. So yeah.
Twitter's leaning hard into it, so I'm sure that one will swing back around.
Twitter, I feel like, is intentionally showing people, like my whole feed is all like right-wing talking heads, even though I don't follow any of them.
Same, and I'm barely on Twitter, but if I go on there, I see so much right-wing stuff, and I literally check it like once a month, and I'm like, where did this come from?
Yeah, it all changed when good old Elon took over.
So far, I don't think I've seen a single Calvinist on on Blue Sky. So that's good. Maybe because that's ironic because you have to be invited to get there. Huh. Guess they're not elect after all. only get on websites so that everyone can get on. That's crazy. So like, I guess speaking of, you know, the internet and our general topic of this episode. So for 99% of people, the story of King David is a story of like, so there's this guy in the Bible who did this, some stuff. Some was good and some was bad. And like, there's the Bathsheba story and okay, that seems bad. But there's like this very, very, very small group of people on Christian internet. And I don't know if it happens on other platforms or if it's just Twitter, where like the David and Bathsheba discourse just pops up monthly. Like there are people who have tracked on the calendar how often it emerges. And every time, every single time, it's like, you know, there's a group of people who say, well, it's very easy to read this as if David did something far more wrong than just adultery. And then there are people who read it and say, I don't know, it could go, you know, it's an old story. It's, you know, there are many interpretations. And then there are these pastors, these, you know, always men, just guys who are like deeply, deeply, deeply committed to the idea that the only way to possibly read it is that David, you know, committed only adultery and murder. Also, he did that. that like he didn't do anything wrong to Bathsheba at all. And it's like this huge, it's like this constantly relitigated thing where everyone just repeats the same things over and over. And I guess as a person who has seen a lot of Christian internet, I'm wondering if like, I guess what that says about those guys who feel that constant need to just to argue that point over and over again. If you have
yeah. Any. Well, I think a hit dog hollers, a good old Southern phrase. Yeah. So I've also seen pastors not only say that David didn't do anything wrong, but that Bathsheba is actually equally at fault for taking a bath and like luring David into lust, I guess. And I think it's because, well, one, if you grew up in purity culture, or like modest is hottest, the whole idea is women need to protect men from stumbling, from lusting. So women need to make sure that their bodies are covered. They're not wearing, you know, leggings. And that if a man...
Christian internet discourse is leggings. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. If it's, yeah, half of the week's leggings, the other half is David and Bathsheba. But yeah, it's this like, I really think that the reason why men get so triggered by the David and Bathsheba debate is if they admit that David is at fault, then they have to admit that they are at fault for lusting after women in their own life. And who knows? We all know that there's lots of abusive pastors that stories have come out later that were, you know, sexually assaulted women, sometimes kids. Which is awful, but I do think that that's why they get so angry and triggered by that particular debate, because they see themselves as David. Mm-hmm. And if David didn't do anything wrong, then they can get off, they can feel better about themselves and how they personally objectify women. Because I don't think you can grow up in that evangelical context and not objectify women. I mean, I grew up in it and I viewed myself as an object, because even if it's not explicitly said that women are objects, it's definitely said implicitly.
Right. Yeah. And the, I mean, it's a really good point you make, the thing about they almost view Bathsheba as the aggressor because she was bathing. I've read scholars who said like, no, that this idea that, and it's like every painting of Bathsheba, she's like naked on the bathtub looking glamorous and glorious. And it's like, no, of course that's how males imagine it, but that's not what she was doing at all. Like, you right. know, she wasn't on display. She wasn't doing anything glamorous. There's no soft focus, right? Like a lot of scholars argue like, no, she was essentially changing her tampon is what she was essentially doing. There is nothing here that anyone should find exciting. Like David is working very hard to be excited by this.
Well, she was like private, like on her own property, like where she lived. It wasn't like she was being just running around streaking in the whatever it would be called, the courtyard. I don't know.
Right. It wasn't like she was wearing spaghetti straps or anything. It
wasn't like she was wearing leggings.
Yeah. Any pastor who is just going to leap to David's defense, I'm like, wow, I hope no one in your church has reported to you that, you know, the youth pastor touched them and you, you know, immediately sided and said, oh, well, if it couldn't be the case, that's a man of God, right?
Right. Like, oh, yeah. Any man that defends David David like aggressively in that way, it's red flags going off 100%.
Yeah, because like, I mean, there's a real life application here, and it's not just like interpretation of a story. Like, I can imagine a way a person could read it and say that like, they had an affair, and I could imagine a way that it could be said to where I'm like, okay, maybe you don't sound so dangerous, but it's like the dismissing the possibility. That just seems insane to me. And honestly, our last episode was on David and Jonathan. It reminds me of the exact same thing, like the complete dismissal of the totally valid interpretation that David and Jonathan might be in love. Like, anyone who says that's not a possibility is like, okay, well, I kind of think you just don't like possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because, well, I remember, so I went to a Christian high school my sophomore year, and we did like a devotional each morning before class in my English class. And our teacher would read like a chapter of different books. And one of the books was like this romance narrative about David and Bathsheba. And the way it's written, it's like this whole, it's written like a romance novel. I mean, obviously without the smut, but it's like, oh, Bathsheba like fell in love with the king and got this opportunity and blah, blah, blah. And so I grew up thinking that David and Bathsheba was this beautiful love story. And it's possible that it turned into that later, but people, like, I was never once taught like the power dynamics of David being a king and, you know, summoning a girl. Like, she didn't have a choice in that matter. Like, even if she went willingly and wasn't like fighting him off, she didn't have a choice. Like, she was, like, she just had to listen. Like, you could be killed if you didn't listen to the king back then.
Yeah. So many of the verbs in the story, I think, just make very clear. My opinion is like, it wasn't consensual, in my opinion. So many of the verbs are like, he sent for her, not like he invited her. It's he sent for her, you know, right. And like he knew that she was there without her husband to defend her. Mm-hmm. David knew that this woman was isolated and alone and had no choice but to like step through his walls. And then what happens? Then he sends her away. Like,
right. She was summoned. It wasn't like he did a promposal or anything. Yes. Just like showed up and asked.
Nothing about this is like David fell in love and so did Bathsheba, which is like, I think that was probably the version I was taught where it's like, guard your heart, you know, and all that. But no, there's no heart here. No heart here at all. Mm-hmm. The power dynamic thing, it makes me think about, you know, these same pastors are people who will leap to the defense of not just other pastors, but also politicians. Sort of thing, you know? So like, there's politics here. There's a lot of politics here.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, no, you're going to naturally defend the person in power in a story if you view yourself as a person in power too.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, in most of the art, they're like sitting on like a fainting couch. It's like all the art is from the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. So like they imagine everything through their perspective. The art is so weird. I think Bathsheba is the most drawn woman from the Bible.
That makes sense.
Yeah. It's like Eve and Bathsheba. It's like, oh, those are the two
naked
can,
ladies.
Yeah. The two we can draw naked. So many different things of those two. are you going to draw like Junia? No.
But they're not perverts. It's fine.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
They're not obsessed with sex. Secular world's obsessed with sex.
Yeah, this is this isn't porn. No, this is mm-hmm. So yeah, this David Bathsheba thing. Folks listening to this, if you're not on Christian Twitter, you gotta get in on this.
And if the debate's not currently happening, just give it a week. It'll probably come back.
Yeah, it like going through David's story, I kept thinking ahead to this episode, like when I put this out, I don't know if it'll be happening then or not. Like there's a small chance it causes it to happen. I don't know.
It's gonna very happen. Well could. I also feel like somewhere around this gets brought up too is the Billy Graham rule.
Debated.
Because I know, like, I think I tweeted it was around the time of one of the David Bathsheba fiasco on Twitter. And I literally just tweeted, the Billy Graham rule is sexist, period. Like, that was it. And those same men lost their mind over that.
The Billy Graham rule, for any listeners who have normal brains who weren't in this rule, is a man and a woman, if they aren't married, shouldn't be alone in a room together. It's sometimes interpreted as beyond just a room. Shouldn't have a meal together. Shouldn't be
not even be alone in public because of how it can be perceived.
Well, technically, they wouldn't be alone if they were in public.
Yeah,
well, their hearts are alone with each other.
Mm-hmm. It's weird too, because like I did not grow up evangelical, so like I had a pretty normal Christian childhood, I would say. So like whenever I was aware of some of these things, but like I never experienced it. So when it's brought to light as like a lot of people experience this, I'm so confused.
Mm.
So weird to me.
Uh-oh. It's so weird to me to think of anyone that like didn't grow up with this.
This reminds me, April, you did an interview with CNN a few months ago about like rapture trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I think, Emily, I think I showed it to you. Like, look, see, someone else.
Oh, yeah. So,
there are dozens of us. Actually, there are dozens of millions of us. But
yeah,
that was another example where it was like, look, this thing I've told you about, it's real.
Oh, my gosh. That made people so mad, too, because they were like, it's not, you're not supposed to have anxiety over it unless you're left behind. I'm like, whoa. That's so stupid. You don't even hear yourself. Oh my gosh. I had people after that article like reaching out to me. Like some people were like in their 60s who literally thought they were the only one who ever had fear about being left behind from the rapture, and that like, they just felt validated. Cause like when you're in those circles too, you don't talk about how you're scared to be left behind, because then that just opens the door for you to be asked like a million other questions. Like, well, why is there sin in your life? Like, why would you be left behind? And don't want to, do you not have the assurance of salvation? You got to know that you know that you know. Like, why don't you know?
Mm-hmm. And it's typically, I feel like it's the people who are so sure that they would be raptured that are the type of people that like, I want zero to do
I with. Don't
want to
be raptured with you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like this specific breed of person that is like not a good human.
If you're
oh
really
my gosh. Concerned. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had the exact same thing. Like, I remember as a kid, there was a day me and my friend, we left like the water park and we were driving, and the highway was like mysteriously empty, and this thought goes through my head like, shit, I missed the rapture. And it was just like the normalest thought. It was the same thought I would have if like I forgot to turn the oven off. It was that level of thought where like, oh, of course I missed the rapture. Like, I, you know, I did this or that thing wrong earlier today. But yeah, that somebody who's 60 years old and like hasn't been able to talk about it, that's insane, because they caught the full brunt of it, you know, like they were around for like Hal Lindsey and everything.
Oh yeah, they saw A Thief in the Night. Like, I knew about A Thief in the Night, but that was like a 70s movie. We got like the rebranded Kirk Cameron Left Behind books, and they freaking made Left Behind for kids, which is what I read. So I read them all. So I was like 10 years old, literally like dreaming about being left behind. But like the books take place where they are left behind, and then they start this whole like underground, like, oh, you can still be Christian and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, if they get caught, they get their head chopped off. So I had an irrational fear of guillotines as a kid.
Yeah.
I don't think I thought about being raptured one time my entire life. So,
wow.
Yeah.
For you.
Weird.
Congratulations.
I read the Left Behind books at the time. I didn't read the YA books until just a few months ago, where I was like, oh my God, this is the worst book I've ever read. But finally, my child is being represented in a book. I feel seen by this book about how terrible I am.
Oh my gosh. Seriously, if you're it's like, there was no limit to the things you could be afraid of, because there was the rapture, not only being left behind, but I also, fear is not the right word, but I had anxiety because I didn't want the rapture to happen too soon, because mm-hmm. I really wanted to have sex before when I got raptured.
I was like, I'll never drive a car, but feeling bad about that makes me a horrible sinner, so I'll probably miss the rapture, so I'll get to drive a car, but I won't, because the Antichrist will have taken everything over, and there'll be murder, plague, scorpions everywhere, and you don't get to drive a car when the thundering, crumbling mountain of blood is falling from the sky. And as you see right here on this chart that I've memorized, that will happen exactly 2.7 years into the tribulation. And like, yeah, this is every fucking day.
I would say like as a kid though, I was more excited about the rapture, because the idea of me being left behind, like I didn't think I was bad. But that definitely came from like kids' church and Sunday school and it was a good, I got it all from all places.
Yeah. Yeah, I just imagine that would be really hard because, like, church for me, thank goodness, was like the place I wasn't traumatized, so that was my escape. You know, thank heavens. But like, I can't imagine feeling it, and I know it's like different than what I experienced, but like feeling like that was the same thing you were getting at home as you were in the church.
Yeah, my dad was more like he was still teaching me the same things, but he took it as more of like, oh, we get to go to heaven and be raptured, and like, and I didn't really express my fear to him, so he was much more of like framing it in this positive, like, this is a good thing to look forward to, I guess. Yeah, but there were like other things that were not good. Like I grew up at the height of purity culture, so like my virginity was talked about a lot as this amazing thing that I was doing and saving myself for, where like my brother's wasn't, so that was kind of weird. Looking back,
purity culture was definitely a part of church for me too, I don't remember like all, I think being that was maybe the one thing, everything else didn't seem so bad. Or
you didn't have like the magnifying refracting hall of insanity,
right?
You just sort of had to
Oh my gosh, there's so many things like when I look back on just evangelical culture, and obviously so much of this is still going on in churches, but it's so interconnected, and it's so weird to say some of this stuff out loud now. And it's like, even sometimes when I make skits and stuff, I'll be like, oh, this is a little exaggerated. And then I'll like have like a memory that I've repressed that comes back. I'm like, oh no, that's not exaggerated.
I feel like sometimes there's still like this protective mode you get into.
Yes.
Where it's like, you don't want to talk bad, or you don't want, like, at least for me and some of my experiences, even like abuse that I went through as a kid, like I can't mention or even put something, like, I'm a Facebook person, so like I can't put something on Facebook sometimes when it strikes me, because like some of those people are still connected to me through other relatives or whatever, and I feel like, well, they don't need to be a part of this, or I don't need to let them know that this happened because they still like that person or whatever. And it's just weird, and I feel like that happens in the church a lot too. You kind of get protective over these experiences sometimes. Like, you can talk bad about it, but you don't want to make other people feel bad about it.
Yeah.
Well, you don't feel that way given what you do, but like, I don't know.
I totally get that. I think I feel it, especially when it comes to my dad. Like, I don't talk about my dad too much because he passed away in 2011. So he's like not around anymore to defend himself, I guess. And really the worst teachings I got weren't from him. It was from the world around me. Cause my dad was actually, I think, because it's like weird. I think my dad was one of the few feminists that I knew, but he was only a feminist really when it came to me. But like from an early age, he was like, April, don't let any man tell you what you can and cannot do. Like, you could be a preacher if you want to be a preacher. Like, he was egalitarian before egalitarian was cool. It was just weird though, because like the church we went to never had a woman pastor. And so like he was like saying these things and like empowering me as a person, but the culture around me wasn't that. Mm-hmm. So I still grew up with this idea that I was an object. But I think because I had my dad's voice saying like, think for yourself, don't let anyone tell you what you can and can't do, and like, you like, just because you're a woman doesn't mean you can't do things that men can do, I think is one reason why I was able to deconstruct where a lot of people weren't. And I just like, he definitely had his problems, 100%. Like, we were Christian nationalists, it was not good, but like, there was like the one thing that he got right.
I feel like I always see it, and that's actually exactly what I was going to ask you, if like, if he was sort of a foothold out, like that element of him, because you know, I think, but for me, it was just the most random stuff that I look back and like, oh right, like I read Jurassic Park when I was tiny, and it planted this like science might be real thing in my mind, and that like eventually flourished. And it feels like everyone who's able to deconstruct, they like luck into all these just random footholds, and like, you know, a pastor telling his daughter, you can be anything you want to be. That's a pretty good example, I think.
Yeah. I find it annoying now. Like, you know, I sometimes get really fundamentalist atheists, or just people that weren't raised religiously, that almost get mad at my old self for like, you know, because I'm very open about, I used to be very problematic. I was very conservative. I was a bigot. I was homophobic. I was a lot of these things. And the reason why I say that is because I hope that people that are those things now can see themselves in my story and hopefully change you know, much easier said than done. Some people have, most people haven't, but I'm trying. But I get these people sometimes that are like, well, why didn't you just like, oh, you're an idiot. How could you ever believe in the rapture? Or like almost like looking down on people who are indoctrinated. I'm like, I don't think you understand what it means to be indoctrinated. Like you don't know what you don't know, especially when you're raised in it, like from a baby. It's not like you know deductive reasoning when you're two and you're being taught that about sin and Jesus and heaven and hell and the rapture. It's like, oh, I bet every adult is lying to me right now. Yeah. Because also they're not lying to you. Like they genuinely believe it too. It's like cycles of indoctrination. And I wish people could just have more grace. Also, yelling at someone for being stupid isn't helpful in any way.
Not yelling at someone for saying I used to be stupid.
Right. Right.
You're yelling at someone who no longer exists. What are you yelling about?
I know.
We talked about those things a lot, though, where there's like this, there are types of people that just want to, one, say there's no point in arguing, you're not going to change anyone's mind. But like, I think you guys especially are proof that you can change someone's mind over time and maybe not in a conversation. But also people that just like look down on you or believe that they would have been the one that couldn't have been indoctrinated. Yeah. And it's like, that's not how this works.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Like, how do you think this system has existed for centuries, millennia, if it didn't work? Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. the grandest Reddit fedora atheist, if they had been born where I was, they would have been lucky to make it out, period. And like, this is a thing you talk about that, like, that I do admire, that like, it might be something that I feel timid about talking about, that like those old bad ideas. Like I was listening to your evangelical-ish podcast. I mean, let's say like a plug noise.
plug. Yeah. I saw that was awful. Don't use that.
We're going to cut that. We're going to use it. I talked to the director of the 1946 movie about how the word homosexuality did not appear in any biblical translation until the year 1946, when someone just put it there and said, and then said, whoops, we shouldn't have put it there because that's not what Paul meant. But like in that episode, you talked about how, like, and you've talked about it elsewhere as well, about how, like, at some point you just have to take all these things that you're taught and you just have to take this leap into like I think you call it a theology of not being a dick anymore. And then once you do that, you realize like, oh no, that it actually lines up. It actually works. Like we talked in the last episode with Mason about like, once you have, you know, the bias of love, I think the Rachel Held Evans quote we use, where it's like, you realize it actually works. It all lines up just fine once you take that leap.
Yeah. Because when you're in it, you're like holding on to your theology so tightly. For a number of reasons, but you know, probably the biggest one is that if one part of your theology falls, so much of the other also falls, because it's so interconnected and so tightly knit that if you pull one thread, it all kind of unravels. So you just, it's like this just really tense, just like white knuckling belief system, because it really doesn't make sense. If you look at it logically, there's a lot of it that is cherry picked and hypocritical, and like things that I knew when I was in it, like I would have moments of being like, yeah, that doesn't make sense. But then that would freak me out because I could not go there. Because if I went there, I knew how we treated other people that left the church. You know, they were blacklisted, they were called, you know, satanic, demonic, fallen, whatever you want to talk, Jezebel. And they lose their community. They leave the church, they lose family, they lose, you know, pretty much most of the people that you've known, especially if you grow up in it. So it's much easier to just ignore and push off and just try to hold on as tight as you can. Because it's scary. It's scary waking up one day and thinking, oh, shoot, is everything that I've believed a lie? Like, that's not fun. No one wants to go through that. And if you go through that, you're typically going through that alone at first, because you're terrified of telling anybody around you. Because if you do, they're just going to be like, oh, no, that's dangerous. That's slippery slope. That sounds like Satan talking. And then you're like, well, shoot, I don't want to go to hell. And it's like these constant just, the mental gymnastics you have to constantly do to make it work is exhausting. And then when you finally let it go, it's like, oh shoot, gosh, it's so much peaceful, so much more peaceful. Like my brain can rest. I can just like live and exist.
And it's not that bad. It's not that scary. Like, yeah,
no.
every like gigantic rebellion I did from church viewpoint, once it happened, it was like, oh, okay. So all that fuss was, Emily, you're talking about like that, that there's this like doomer idea that like nobody can change, don't even bother trying, which always drives drives me absolutely crazy, because it's like, okay, yeah granted, you're not going to change Ted Cruz's mind, but but you're going to change the mind of some onlooker, some 99% indoctrinated kid. You're going to use the biblical term, you're going to plant a seed.
oh my gosh.
But like, I will never, ever, ever believe that there's anyone who can't change. And like, if I'm naive about that, then so be it, because like, sorry, it's why I'm here, you know?
Yeah, right. No, I literally, in high school, I made a MySpace group, which is dating myself because I said MySpace, but
we're good, it's fine.
Okay, good. Well, I made a group and the name of it was I'm a Christian, therefore I'm a Republican. Wow. To me, they're like one and the same. So, you know, if I could go from that to this, anybody could change.
Well, and that's funny to me too, because I don't know. And I did not grow up in the South. I grew up in Kansas City, and politics and religion were never hand in hand for me. Mm. So like, I could not have told you if Christians were Republicans or Democrats. And here it's like, that is all it is. And so it's so different for me looking back on like, and maybe I was just oblivious because I had so much other things going on, and that's fine. If I was, I'll take it. But I don't remember that being like a big thing.
April, as someone who like, I guess, has been on both sides of the trenches, how do you like compare the culture war of now with like the one we grew up in? Like, obviously we have a different perspective on it, but does it seem like it's essentially changed in any ways?
Yes. I would say generally the talking points are the same. The overall goal is the same, but I feel like it used to be more subtle. Like it wasn't as in your face about it. Like, I feel like, okay, the Christian nationalism that I came from, we voted for George Bush, right? Like, he was, whatever you think about George Bush, he's got lots of problems, but he wasn't Donald Trump. Yeah. You know, like he at least seemed like a decent human being. Like, he'd be someone you'd want to go grab a beer with, or like, he loved his family. He just seemed like a your nice typical, a nice guy. Right. And really most of them,
he like verbally defended Muslims at one point.
Yeah. Right. Which my family was not a fan of, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like he didn't always toe the line. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, but like, those were the people that we voted for. And, you know, and Bill Clinton, when he had his sex scandal, the people that I knew, because I was a kid at the time, but people were so mad at him. They were calling for him to be impeached and be removed from office because character mattered. Mm-hmm. And if a president isn't going to be loyal to his wife, how is he going to be loyal to the country, was like rhetoric that I heard. So I feel like there was at least, and granted, I still think they were complete hypocrites back then. Like, I think they were saying that to stay in power and to keep their people in power, which is easier to see now. But I feel like people at least tried to put on the show of the typical Christian morality that they preach. And I think Trump really changed that, because he enabled the more violent aspects of evangelicalism, which I think have always been there underneath the surface, and like the hateful stuff that used to be kind of hidden in Christianese. Like, it was all still there. The white supremacy and the racism, the misogyny, that has always been there. But now I just think Trump emboldened a lot of people to...
He made them feel okay about saying it.
Right.
He's the leader of the free world. Like, yeah.
Right. And he, you know, he's telling them, fight for your rights, fight for your country. And, you know, you have people like Sean Foyt, who have made their whole personality about being persecuted. So I don't know if y'all saw his whole guitar getting stolen fiasco.
Oh, I didn't even see that. I just saw today he said someone helped him sneak into the Capitol so he could lay hands on random stuff.
Oh my gosh. I would say, I think people are being more honest about their feelings now because of Trump. But I think those feelings were always there, if that makes sense. I mean, I grew up with a persecution complex too. I literally was told growing up, because I was homeschooled until middle school, and I went to middle school. It was a public middle school. Prepared to be persecuted. Like, I was like egging people on. I literally made a giant like neon yellow poster board that I cut out to say Jesus save souls. It's huge. And I put it on my locker and I was like, I was like daring people to persecute me. And like, the only person that commented on the sign was someone that told me she liked it. This is in Texas. And pretty much everyone in my class was Christian.
Yeah. I went through the exact same experience. It was in middle school and like my first year of public high school is like going in. It was like, okay, into the war zone, the belly of the beast. Here we go. There's going to be Ray Bolts is going to be singing about my execution and the Carmen's going to make a video. And like, yeah. And then it's like, you know, kid walks up. He's like, hey, man, you're like Five Iron Frenzy, me too. I'm like, oh, okay. He must be a spy, right? He must be. Who's he?
That Ray Bolts video, Pledge Allegiance to the Lamb. I'm assuming that's what you're talking about. And then Carmen's America Again, which is like all about persecution at school.
And then and Columbine did not help.
Yeah, once Columbine. Oh, yeah. And St. Cassie was once like every lie was told about like a girl who was murdered and like she was turned into like a merch factory.
Oh my gosh, I know.
And then it's really sad because it's sad what happened to her without lies being told about it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and how many kids' church services did I have to sit through where they were like, if a gunman comes into your school and puts a gun to your head and asks you, do you believe in God? Do you have the courage to say yes and see Jesus in heaven or say no and be ashamed of him and God be ashamed of you and then you go to hell?
That was perfect. That's exactly how it went down. See, there are so many things that I've told Emily about that like are now being confirmed for her as real. I think you believe me, but still, it's good to be verified.
Yeah. And I don't remember at my church ever talking about calling. I mean, I'm sure we prayed for them. But like, I don't remember having these conversations about Columbine.
I just remember going to school every day hoping I got shot. Because that would mean
you'd like fantasize about it. Because they also put like martyrs on a pedestal. And then like, there's no greater way to die than to die for God.
Yeah. Because like, we found this story from the first century about Romans killing Christians. And okay, what's that got to do with me?
Or the Fox's Book of Martyrs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They would like read some of those stories in youth group. And like, some of them would be like, they were burned at the stake, but the Holy Spirit was so strong, they didn't feel pain. It's like, how do you know?
Stood there and preached for 17 hours. And like, yeah, there's so much crazy stuff in there. They were thrown into kilns. They were thrown into bags full of scorpions.
What a childhood.
Yeah.
My kids don't know about hell or the rapture. Good. And I'm like, man, I just look at them. I'm like, they get to actually have a childhood where they can live.
There was, I felt this moment of like a broken cycle. There was a day we were walking through a school where like we were there for like someone's basketball game or something. And our daughter walked past a pew and she said, she called it a bench. She didn't call it a pew. And I was like, oh, she doesn't know what pew is. Let her out.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Yeah, my daughter the other day, I think she might have overheard Beecher, my spouse, and I talking about something. I think I might have mentioned Satan, and she was like, who's Satan? It's like, oh,
someone I know very well. One of my oldest friends.
Oh yeah,
so yeah, that's an awesome way to end. Let's go with Satan.
Satan.
April, this is great. Thank you for joining us. What all stuff do you have to promote? Battle off whatever you like.
Yeah. So I co-host a podcast called Evangelicalish with a couple other pastors, and we just basically talk about current events and weird evangelical things. My partner and I, my spouse is non-binary, which is like part of my deconstruction story, but we did a podcast. It's just like, it's not ongoing. We basically tell our story and then it's done, about how we went from like evangelical darlings to a queer couple, but still Christian. And so that's called the Non-Binary Marriage Podcast. And then if you just want to follow me on the interwebs, I am at April A. Joy on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Thank you again to April. The story of David is a story about a lot of things. A lot of people see loyalty and humility and faithfulness, and those are there at times, though honestly even less than I expected. Like, when we started this, I figured, you know, there'd be a big contrast between the hero of Israel and his actual actions, but he's even worse than I, you know. Yeah.
I mean, I don't really see outside of like him killing Goliath in the beginning why people loved him so much anyway, at any point, except for maybe Jonathan. He was kind to him.
Yeah, I think he, it was cool when he was like a rogue renegade with a boyfriend. That was pretty cool of him. That was about it.
Yeah.
And then he got that damn Goliath sword and
went to crap.
Lost his darn mind. David is a story of, you know, loyalty and stuff. It's also a story of greed, control, colonization. Remember the very first thing David is recorded as saying, back when he was just a shepherd boy, paraphrased, "If I destroy the body of that enemy soldier, I'll gain the power to possess the body of a princess." David, just like Joseph in Genesis, was an underdog brother who got a taste of power and overdosed on it. Joseph became an enslaver for the Pharaoh, and David became an enslaver for himself. Just like the book of Judges, the book of Samuel repeatedly shows how a kingdom went wrong, why the contract of Deuteronomy failed, and how each generation infects the next. Crooked priest Eli started this story by degrading a woman and failing as a father, and he's the man who raised that woman's son, Samuel, who also failed as a father. Self-interested prophet Samuel manipulated and endangered Saul, just as Saul would do to David. Paranoid King Saul constantly tried to hoard power by getting David killed in the name of God, just as David would do to others. Power-hungry King David destroyed the bodies of men and seized the bodies of women. One of David's sons will continue his violence against women, and another will be even more addicted to the power of having a harem full of bodies. Who will stop this cycle of male failure? It's possible the Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings story was written to point toward a king who arrived after Solomon. But since, spoiler alert, that guy will also fail, then here we are 3,000 years after David, where the question still stands. Who will stop this cycle of male failure? One answer can be found in the actions of the prophet Nathan, a man who spoke up. Another answer from Hannah, the prophet who began the book of Samuel, "Not by might will a man prevail." So the other thing about David, the thing that I was always taught is David is a model for Jesus.
Yeah, I never heard that, so that's good, I guess.
Huh? Wow. That's one of the main things I heard about the what we call the Old Testament. So back in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, God says something about David's legacy. And if you're raised in a church anything like mine, your ears will light up at these words. God said to David, "I will raise up your offspring after you, and I will establish his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will punish him with blows inflicted by human beings." Many Christians read that as a prophecy about Jesus. And I'm not saying it can't be that, it can't be two things at once, but Samuel's authors intended to refer to David's son eventually building the temple in the city of David. Scholar David Gunn says, "The New Testament descriptions of Jesus as the son of David, because Jesus is linked to the royal dynasty by genealogy, has predisposed many Christian readers to idolize the king. Yet Samuel's narrator opens other possible perspectives, even in those narratives that elicit admiration. The narrator's undercutting of the hero is ubiquitous. Is the story perhaps not about righteousness, but self-righteousness?" End quote. However, there are figures in this story who stand for Jewish values Jesus will stand for, like the priest who altered rules in order to feed a hungry outlaw, and the necromancer who made sure a terrified man ate a last meal, and Nathan speaking truth to power. And I think someone else in this story reflects several things about Jesus. Being described by the Bible as a slaughtered innocent lamb is one thing Bathsheba has in common with her most famous descendant. In fact, whoever wrote Jesus' lineage in the Gospel of Matthew noted he descended from her even though she was a foreigner. Jesus said, "Whatever you do to the vulnerable, you do to me." And there's nobody more vulnerable than a woman isolated by a king. Jesus also said men must stop judging women, putting him on Bathsheba's side against not just David, but every man who since assumed she was asking for it. But Bathsheba is not just a slaughtered lamb. Jesus said, "Earth becomes more like the kingdom of God whenever power structures are inverted." He learned that from his mother, the kingmaker of Luke chapter 1. And here's an inversion. A foreign widow outlived her captor in his own throne room. Wilda Gaffney writes of Solomon's coronation after David dies a shriveled up failure. Bathsheba is no longer an abducted and raped widow. She is now the first queen mother of the United Monarchy. End quote. Bathsheba's chosen king will become Israel's most powerful monarch, but considering her influence over him, she might be first or second on that list. In Bathsheba's final scene, the new king bows as she takes her throne. The ascent of Queen Bathsheba serves to remind us this: worthy is every lamb who has been slain. That's the story of Bathsheba.
She seems pretty good.
Yeah.
All hail the queen.
All hail the queen. There we go. So yeah, this you know, wherever Christians gather online going forward after Christian Twitter falls apart, the Bathsheba discourse will emerge, and because it always does, and just every time it'll be a glaring red flag.
Can you imagine? She's like up in heaven, right? she's looking down and she's like, they're still trying to pull this crap on me.
Right, right.
Like, how long do I have to be gone before my story changes?
Before, like, someone reads it, you know? Yeah. So yeah, thank you folks for listening. The next part of the story will be mostly less unfun than this one. There is even worse things that happen, but we'll
there's always worse things.
There's always worse things that happen, but we'll the main stuff is King Solomon's coming.
Woo.
King Solomon, the original like finance Instagram fake deep hustle bro.
He sounds like a blast.
Yeah, he's the guys on Instagram who like pay models to stand by them. And
cool.
And they just post captions about, like, I get up at 4 a.m. and I work for 37 hours a day and you should read 19 books a day like me to gain wisdom. Yeah, hustle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's Solomon.
Cool. What a bro.